concern to you, answering your questions on things relating to COVID and Irma and the like, it's my pleasure to maybe give you some context on how we got to where we are with the PERS retirement funds and the like. I am a trustee and chair of the Alaska Retirement Management Board, ARM Board. And that board does two primary things with respect to, in particular, the defined benefit plan, which I suspect most of you folks have retired under. The two things that very much impact your pension and health benefits that ARM Board is responsible for is that the ARM Board are fiduciaries for the investment of the funds in the defined benefit trust funds of PERS. And second, we set a contribution rate, which determines the annual payments by the state and other public employers around which must the amounts that are assessed must cover the actual outlay of funds from year to year, but also provide sufficient amounts to cover the past service costs, that is the unfunded liability, which you've no doubt heard about, which may cause you concerns, but which is an existing fact of life, and that is part of the contribution rates that we assess. The annual payments that the state and the public employers make with respect to defined benefit plans are considerable. And the discussion that my college classmate, Randall Burns, spoke to regarding considering finances and where we're at in the legislature this year, they're gonna have to take up the issue of how much is going to be paid out to cover health costs. So I can tell you that a recent estimate on the cost is when you factor and apply a percentage to the amount of employee wages that are paid, both for the state and for political subdivisions, and you include as well the amounts paid for the defined contribution plans, that is for the employees subsequent to 2005, the total defined benefit and DCR payments by the state would be 30.11% of the total amounts of wages paid, or an amount of about $718 million. So obviously this is a considerable piece that's going to appear in the budgets. It's a contractual obligation, it's set by statute, but it's a figure that exists and it's one that the legislature is going to have to deal with. Now the ARM Board was created in 2005. Why was it created? It was a reaction, and in my opinion, in many respects, an overreaction to a distressing series of events which appeared to shockingly reduce the funded status of the PERS funds. There were at times 100% funding. We enjoyed that. In fact, there was even a point in time where the then PERB, the Public Employment Relations Board, which was setting contribution rates back in those days, was looking at some kind of a payback because we were exceeding 100% funding. Well, that didn't happen, and a series of events basically transpired, and we're gonna talk about that. The story about these events that transpired and how an unfunded liability was created and how ARM Board was created makes, in my opinion, a good story. And it's an Alaska story. And I'd like to share that with you. And it's gonna be based not in my position as chair of the ARM Board, but it's based upon sort of my historical familiarity with a lot of this, based upon the fact that I was an assistant attorney general back in the late 70s. Of course, I was only about 12 years old at the time. And it went on to the private practice, to my private practice experience as an attorney and counsel for the ARM Board and all of its predecessor entities from 1981 to 2014. And then of course, during my tenure as trustee and now chair of the ARM Board. But now, spoiler alert, I'm not gonna wait to the end of this to conclude sort of where we're at in terms of funding and so on. But I need to say to you that your PERS defined benefit plans, including your health plans, are in, I'll call it, reasonably healthy condition. There is not the prospect of your pension payments being not made or that your health plans will not be covered because of a lack of money. You are at approximately a 75% funded level when you include both the pension as well as the healthcare side. And that falls well within and above the median for a lot of plans around the country. And particular, and I would have to emphasize and maybe more specific terms, I have not heard of any intentions on the part of the administration or the legislature to not make the payments that are required on an annual basis and not make those payments that are set by the ARM board as the contribution figure that is to be assessed. Now, this week, I'm told that there is going to be a rollout of, at least the governor's budget. And I don't have access to that. I'm not necessarily the person that's going to hear anything about that, but you know, we should hear a lot about it. And if I guess vigilance is important. And I think when we're dealing with actions taken by the government, vigilance is always important. You need to keep an eye on whether there are efforts in the legislature to not appropriate amounts that have been specified, or if there's substantive legislation that might have some kind of effect on things. So let's go back to why the ARM board was created in this reaction, or in my opinion, overreaction to items. And it was because there was, if you will, a perfect storm of a series of events that occurred in the early 2000s, which saw funded status drop. Now, when that happens, there's going to be people running around and wanting to blame folks and so on. But when you look at how the perfect storm developed, you're going to have to start with the very origins of your PERS fund. And that starts in 1960, when the PERS fund, when the PERS system was created shortly after statehood. Now, the teacher's retirement system, it had existed from 1955 during territorial days. But in 1960, Tier 1 was created. At that time, it was, you were paying 6.75% if you were in a regular line employee in state in under the system, or 7.5% if you were police or fire. The contributions by the employers were then, as now, to be fixed by a review board. At that time, early on, it was going to be fixed by the Public Employment Relations Board, or the Public Employees Retirement Board. In 1975 and 76, health benefits were added to the equation. And when you added together the pension plans as they initially existed and the health benefit plans, plus other tweaks to the pension plans started coming in 1975 and 76. Looking backwards, one can say that they were pretty darn generous. Now, why was everybody so interested in being so generous to public employees at that time? What was happening in 75, 76? The Trans-Alaska Pipeline System was being created. What you needed to do was create an incentive to people to keep people on the farm. You had deputy commissioners running off and getting their 959 card with the Teamsters reinstated. You had lawyers going up driving trucks. You had secretaries going up and being line cooks. There needed to be something to keep folks working with the state. And what you had was basically the embellishments to the PERS fund that started back then. Now, about 1978, the state started looking at this and saying, well, you know, these really might not be as affordable as we were originally thinking. So what kind of issues and what's the law that you're going to look at on how much you can take back what you've given? Well, it all starts with the constitutional provision that existed at the time of statehood, which applies to you. I'm just going to read it. It's Article 12, Section 7. Membership in employee retirement systems of the state or its political subdivisions shall constitute a contractual relationship. Accrued benefits of those systems shall not be diminished or impaired. The notes from the Constitutional Convention on what that was all about indicate that actually a lot of what was designed in that language was to make sure that the teachers who had a system and various other political subdivisions who had retirement plans for their folks, that when you move from territorial status to statehood, that they would not be changed, that they would not be impaired, they would be kept in place. That was an intention behind it. But exactly what was meant about diminution was a subject of some concern. The state folks drew the conclusion, the Division of Retirement Benefits drew the conclusion that at that time, that provisions such as this really took effect only when somebody's rights vested, actually took place. In other words, you could go ahead and change the benefits while you were still an employee, but once you were actually receiving the benefits, well, then and only then could you not make changes. So that was the position of the state as they started looking at maybe shaving back some of the things that had been given in 1960, in the 1975 to 76 timeframe. The Police Officers Association filed a lawsuit when there were some proposed changes to disability claims, disability status for police officers, and for a proposal that would eliminate the distinction between public employees on the line status and police officers and firefighters on the other. The Public Employees Association, the Police and Fire Public Employees Association filed a lawsuit, and that ultimately worked its way up to the Supreme Court of Alaska as Hammond versus Hoffbeck. And then there, the Supreme Court said, your benefits, when we say they can't be diminished, are to be measured based upon the benefits that you acquired at the time that you came on as an employee, or that if it was in, if they were enhanced during the period of time that you were an employee, and we weren't required to assess that status only when you retire. So in other words, the benefits were fixed at employment and they couldn't be changed afterwards. So think about it. What you have is a set of systems that were in place in 1960, 75 and 76, which the state as the administrator thought that they could tweak and change as things maybe became more costly or less affordable. So you, and then you have court language which comes in and says, nope, you can't do that. You can't diminish that. I'm going to call that storm event number one. And it started at the origin. So now what was the structure of the administration of the system at that time? There was no ARM board. There was not even any Alaska State Pension Investment Board at that time. What you had was a Public Employees Retirement Board respecting PERS. There was also a Teachers Retirement Board respecting teachers. The story with teachers is very similar to yours, but I'm focusing, of course, on PERS. And the Public Employees Retirement Board consisted of three folks who comprised the State Personnel Board and two folks who were elected about every 3 years or 4 years. I can't remember the terms that they had. You had an elected office by employees as well as retirees. And that board dealt with appeals. For example, if you made a claim for disability that had been denied by DRB, that went to the to PERB. But the PERB also had a role in setting the contribution rate. Statutorily, it wasn't absolutely clear that they had the paramount authority in it, but they were deferred to and they gave their advice and rendered decisions relating to annual contribution rates. They also had advisory input on investments. And who was investing the funds at that time? There was no citizen board. It was the Department of Revenue, the Commissioner of Revenue, who was the sole source, the sole person, the sole fiduciary investing all of those funds. So if what you have is the Commissioner of Revenue appointed by the governor and clearly a member of the administration, the employer, also doing the investment, I think it's fair to say that that's an inherent conflict that that person might face if they're truly performing their fiduciary obligations. I'm not going to suggest there are improprieties by the Commissioner of Revenue, but it was a pretty logical conclusion that there was a conflict. So in 1992, the state retained the Ford Foundation and others, and legislation was introduced, particularly by Senator Pat Porchot, which created the Alaska State Pension Investment Board. And that board was created with its responsibilities limited to investments. The setting of contribution rates remained with the Public Employees Retirement Board. Now, at about in the late 1990s and 2000s, all of a sudden, you start seeing a significant escalation in healthcare costs. Something that didn't occur back in those halcyon days of 1975 and 76, when things seemed to be relatively stable and doctors, you know, actually came to your house and all that sort of thing. But by the end of the last millennium, healthcare costs were skyrocketing. And the state was now looking at ways to cut back on that. And one of the ways they argued that they would cut back is that no, the diminution clauses of the Constitution didn't apply to healthcare costs. That was something different. That was related only to pension costs. RPEA brought a suit on that. And ultimately it went to the Supreme Court in the Duncan versus RPEA case. And the Supreme Court concluded that indeed your healthcare coverage is something that falls within the ambit of retirement plans protected by the Constitution against impairment. Now there's all kinds of twists and turns because they said there can be systemic choices because to the extent that healthcare costs are systemic and insurance-like, you can do these things. So it's a perpetual battle going on to this day with litigation to this day as to whether particular events constitute a diminution. It's a fact issue. But the premise that it's protected by the Constitution was established in the Duncan versus RPEA case. So I'm going to call that storm event number two. Healthcare costs also fixed and determined that they couldn't be diminished, or that the coverage for those things cannot be significantly diminished by the state. 2000, the year 2000 comes through and 9/11 occurs. And then for a couple of years afterwards, you will recall that there was a significant economic downturn. That's called lousy investment returns. That's storm event number three. It's an event that covers everybody. All folks across the country, whether they're protecting pension plans, whether they're trying to work through their own portfolios or whatever, were affected by that. But that's storm event number three. About this time, in fact, it started coming up about the time that the Public Employment Retirement Board started thinking about, gosh, we're at 100% funding. Maybe we should start maybe giving that back. All of a sudden, in a surprising coincidental turn of events, the administration presents through the then actuary the notion of the mortality tables were changing. We're all living longer. Well, we know that. But the timing of the delivery of that report, which is something that the actuaries have to take into account, was just, don't you think, coincidental with the fact that there was 100% funding at that time. And as soon as you add a mortality table which recognizes that an actuary is going to have to consider that retirees live longer and are entitled to their defined benefits longer, you've got a more costly system. That's storm event number four. Then storm event number five occurs about this time, where the then actuary basically screws up the math and fails to bring the right experts to bear and misadvises the decision makers at that time, the Public Employees Retirement Board, the administration, on quite frankly, just how high those contribution rates should be. Ultimately, actuarial malpractice lawsuits were filed against that actuary. And ultimately, in the largest actuarial malpractice award or settlement in the history of the nation at that time, $500 million was recovered from that actuary for these errors, some of which were very specifically covered up. But now think about the fact that you weren't told to seek a contribution rate high enough to cover all of these things. Well, that means somewhere along the line, you're gonna have to pay, and it was too low at that time. But what happened to that money? Well, employers didn't have to contribute to the funds. They went out and spent it on things like police and fire protection, schools, teachers, what have you. So it's the argument would be that while it's true that the funds didn't benefit, the state, the public employers benefited. But if you look at it from the narrow perspective of who's going to ultimately pay the piper about pensions that are ultimately due, the fact remains that actuarial malpractice occurred and basically misadvised the decision makers on how high the contribution rate should be. So then about 2005 in the Murkowski administration, you now have things have changed dramatically. The amount of contributions required to maintain a whole system have gone up dramatically, and somebody's got the blame. Somebody screwed up. So what do legislators or administrators do in those instances? Well, they sort of reconfigure everything, change some rules, and try to tighten things up. Not all of their decision making is bad in that, because clearly the series of storms occurred and something needed to happen. So the arm board was what happened. And in addition to that, in 2005, probably the bigger event really is that for all employees after the effective date of legislation passed in 2005, so July 1, 2006, all employees that got hired by the state and political subdivisions after that went from a defined benefit plan, such as I'm sure all of the folks listening in here have retired under, to a defined contribution plan. That's a policy choice with all kinds of ramifications on employee retention and so on. We don't need to go into that here. That's a policy choice that was made. You know, but it was made on the assumption that given this shocking development on unfunded liability, the state couldn't afford a DB plan, couldn't afford to have continuing prospective uncertain liabilities like that. So they said, okay, we're going to consolidate the decision-making. We're going to create the Alaska Retirement Management Board, which not only does the monitoring of the investments, but it's also going to be charged with setting the contribution rates. You plug that all into one spot. Eliminated the Public Employees Retirement Board. It eliminated the Teachers Retirement Board and put it all into one box. It also required an enhanced amount of actuarial review. You have an initial actuary. You're required, the board is required, to then have a second actuary review that. And every 4 years or so, you have another actuary look at both of these to make sure everything's all square. So this arm board was created as a consolidation of responsibilities. And that board is a 9-person board. I'm proud to be a chair of that board now. And I basically at the board meeting just last week, I was reelected as chair once again. But the board consists of 9 folks, 2 of whom are by law nominated through the unions representing PERS employees. I'm one of those. Dennis Moen from Southeast Alaska is the second one. There are 2 teachers retirement system folks who are nominated by the teachers unions. And Gail Harbo and Bob Williams are those persons. And with that nomination, the governor is restricted to making an appointment coming from those slates of nominations. Beyond that, you have persons who are appointed by the governor at the governor's choice. I mean, obviously people can have input on who they might be, but it's the governor's choice. You have a municipal finance officer that happens to be now Lauren Bretz, who's a municipality of Anchorage employee. Then you have 2 public members. And by that, I mean folks who have no association with PERS. And there are 2 relatively new members, Alan Hippler, who was appointed a couple of years ago. He's a banker from Anchorage. And Michael Collins, who is our most recent appointee, who is an investment advisor from Wasilla. And then you have the 2 commissioners, the Commissioner of Revenue, Lucinda Mahoney, and Commissioner of Administration, Kelly Chewbacca. The board is staffed by the Department of Revenue. Zach Hanna, the new CIO, is the principal with respect to Department of Revenue investment functions. We work always with the Department of Administration and the Division of Retirement Benefits because there are a lot of obligations, both with respect to the actuary, as well as working on defined contribution issues. And by the way, when you talk about defined contribution, you can really talk about, if you will, participant directed plans where you have your own opportunity to select your own choices. So that would apply to those of you that still have SBS accounts or deferred comp accounts, and you can make choices among those. Well, the arm board plays a role that coordinates with the Department of Administration on presenting you an appropriate slate of choices. So has this creation of the arm board, has it proved out right? Has the goal been reached? Has it been achieved? Well, guess what? We're not back at 100% funding, but we have improved the funded status of the plans. I'm proud of the participation that the arm board has had in that, because I think among other things, we have a somewhat greater voice, a somewhat greater level of expertise. And I think it's fair to say that some of the arm board members of a few years ago, particularly Chris Ershinger, former municipal finance officer out of Seward, was paramount in this. We were very helpful in getting a major extra appropriation from the legislature during the last year of Sean Parnell's administration, $3 billion. Two of that went to the teachers, but $1 billion of it went into the PERS account. Now, at the time, though, the legislature also added some little kickers in that required and set rules with respect to how you would actuarially account for the remaining unfunded liability. They set out a level schedule of payments spread out over 25 years. So in a sense, the annual payments were somewhat reduced rather than requiring significant payments upfront with lower payments later. I think that there's been greater oversight. There's been greater attention to the actuarial issues. There's been greater attention to matters. And could there be another perfect storm of events coming up? Well, I think we've got the actuarial assessment buckled down more. We've got an excellent staff at the Department of Revenue working on these things. I think we obviously lessons learned exists, and that's always part of it. So where are we at right now? Well, you get a range of ways to calculate an unfunded liability, or if you will, funded status. If you look at the actuarial reviews on it, which is what we base our contribution rate calculations on primarily, basically as of June 30 of this year, the assessment would be the pension fund is at 63.6% of funding, but that's not the end of the story because the health component, which is about 40% of what the pension plan is 113% funded. So if you combine the two of those, that's where you get to this common denominator, this common figure of around 75% funded status for the PERS funds. I'm not going to submit to you that it's absolutely perfect and you can't say it's blazing in glory because, you're talking about 95% to 100%. But there are very, very few pension funds that are at that level. The contribution rate that is set. There's sort of a floor that was fixed in 2010 by the 2008 by the legislature that provided that all public employees, all participants would pay at least 22% of their total payroll into the funds, and that the state would then be responsible for the excess above 22%. So currently, though, the contribution rate that's most likely to be fixed is going to be in the nature of about just a bit over 24%. So when you look at what the contributions are for the state, the total amount of employee wages throughout the state, that includes both political subdivisions as well as the state. The state itself picks up about 40% of that. So 40% of 24% applied to the total wages of everybody. You have an additional component that's added on to the top of that, which is this additional state contributions above 22%. So that would be that difference between 24.01 and 22%. Then you've got the whole ongoing obligation to fund the employer contribution, which doesn't quite match, but comes close to matching employee contributions in the DC plans, the defined contribution plans that continue on to this day. Now, just by way of comparison, it would be interesting to currently the DB payroll, those folks who are still working under defined benefit plans, so it's going to be mostly tier three folks, is $842 million across the state. For the contribution for the defined contribution plan, in other words, employees that joined up 2006 and later, it's $1,543 million. So you can see that. Not surprisingly, as time goes on, you're going to have more folks in the defined contribution plan than the defined benefit plan for a lot of self-evident reasons. So the last thing I want to just touch on briefly is the investment issues. I think you're in good stead with the investment plans from the Department of Revenue. It's a well-diversified account. Income investments are about 22%, domestic equities 27%, and then you have things like private equity, real estate holdings, and the like. This year, the earnings are not reaching what our actuarial assumption was, which is 7.38%. That's impacted because of a couple of things. One, of course, we had that big March downturn as COVID hit. We also have a smoothing approach, so we're not quite making up for that. But there are other things that basically countervail in terms of actuarial calculations. And that includes some of the federal rules like this EGWP process, and then also the 25-year amortization over time of what our obligations are. In-house, the Department of Revenue is actually doing investments in-house of about 45% of the assets. So that saves a lot of fees. And the issue du jour is, quite frankly, all right, we're in a low income environment, low interest environment. How do we make what we want to make? How do we go forward with getting as much as we can? And bear in mind that what we're always doing is we're looking over 25-year horizons in terms of income, expected earnings, and so on, is this concept of risk tolerance. If you want to go out and have the prospect of earning, you know, double-digit figures rather than something that's more pedestrian, well, that not surprisingly increases the amount of risk. And quite frankly, when you're talking with pension funds, the risk tolerance is a little bit different. We're dealing with investing your money. And so that becomes an issue that's of concern. So what should you folks look out for? Well, again, vigilance is important. It's important to watch what your legislators do in terms of making sure that they're funding what they're, you know, advised to fund, that there's not changes there. Make sure that look to see if the legislators aren't doing things such as maybe modifying the actuarial way you calculate things. Because bear in mind, what the legislation says is are the rules that we deal with under PERS. Those are the rules that we as effectively as trustees have to follow. The statutes are our covenants, are our rules of the road. So we need to make sure, if you will, that there's not changes there that are going to adversely impact things. I don't see these things happening. You're protected by case law. There's ongoing litigation that seeks to protect you more specifically and assuredly in various other things, such as in the, you know, the DVA area and likewise. But I think rather than seeing folks mess with, say, the, you know, the pension rules that you're facing, those are pretty mathematical or pretty well fixed. What you see is maybe, I'll call it a little bit more aggressiveness in dealing with interpretations on what you're entitled to under your health plans. That's where you start seeing a little tension between, you know, your benefit receipts and what, say, maybe the Department of Administration as administrator of the plans is doing. So thank you very much. I hope this gives you a little bit of context of where we're at and, you know, gives you maybe some assurances that things are reasonably well, but nevertheless, it requires your attention to it. So I hope that's helpful. And, you know, there's places that you can look for information on that. I think Wendy's going to post a few of the items, but there is an Alaska Retirement Management Board website that you can access either through the Department of Administration or the Department of Revenue on their sites. It's got a lot of interesting documents. You can read charts, graphs, reports, actuarial returns, and so on until you're blue in the face, but the information is there. Use it if you're interested. Thank you very much. And I guess maybe if there's time, if I haven't run on too long, I'm happy to take some questions. That's up to you.
Okay, Rob, thank you so much. And we did have one question that came up in the chat so far. And that was, is Alaska still the only state without a defined benefit plan for its retirees?
No, I don't think that's the case. I think that there still are some defined benefit plans floating around. I can't give you the specific citations, but not everybody has done away with it. Now, it also may be too, that when you talk about existing defined benefit plans, you know, that could be historical like we have, which is defined benefits only for past employees. But I believe that there still are defined benefit plans, but I just can't tell you which ones they are. We're in the minority though.
Okay, one other question that came up was, do you have this as a written presentation?
No, I made it all up.
Okay, hang on one more.
I appreciate you asking me that. No, I do not have it in writing.